യോന്തപ്രവിശ്യമവാച മാം പ്രസുപ്തം സഞ്ജീവയതി അഖില സിദ്ധിധരസ്സുധാമ്ന അന്യാംശ്ച ഹസ്തചരണശ്രവണത്വവാദിൻ പ്രാണാന്നമോ ഭഗവതി പുരുഷായ ലഭ്യ. വി ഗോ ഡൗൺ ടു ദ സുപ്രീം റിയാലിറ്റി ഹു ഇസ് എ ഇൻഡ്വെല്ലർ, ദ ഇമ്മനന്റ് റിയാലിറ്റി ആൻഡ് എനർജൈസർ ഓഫ് ദ എൻ്റയർ ക്രിയേഷൻ. ഓൾ പീസ്, പീസ്, പീസ്. So we were dealing with some of the verses of the sixth chapter in the last class. There are a few important verses which are very closely related to spiritual life in this sixth chapter. If you have got a book with you, you can take the third verse. Otherwise, no need to refer any book. The verse is this: Arurukshor Muniyayogam Karma Karanam Uchchade Yogarudhasya Tasseva Shama Karanam Uchchade. This is the verse. It's a very, very profound verse. Two terms are used here in the Sanskrit verse. I shall explain in English, then it becomes very clear. One is Arurukshuhu, the other one is Arudha. Two levels of spiritual life. People in their spiritual journey have to pass through different stages. Two stages are mentioned here. There are beginners in spiritual life who are naturally very active, not necessarily very contemplative. But they have a desire to practice contemplation, meditation and so on. But generally they are very active. As I said earlier, every minute our mind is being dragged towards external objects of enjoyment by the five senses of perception. The eyes, the ears, the touch, the taste, and the smell. You can very easily observe our own day-to-day experiences. When you sit here, and when you hear a sound coming from the road, from a vehicle which is running, that sound waves come to the ears, and mind also will be dragged to that object. So the moment you hear the voice, you think of the vehicle running or moving somewhere outside. So our mind is gone there. So the sense of hearing, that is ears, take our mind to an object. Rather, the mind is made aware of that object when mind and ears come together. Similarly, when you see an object, when mind is present there, then you become aware of that object. Just looking at object is not enough. Mind also should go along with the eyes. Then only we become aware of that object. That's why there are many people who cannot concentrate when they read or when they do any book. The reason is, suppose you are reading a book, and if your mind becomes aware of a vehicle on the road because of the sound coming from there, then what happens? Your mind is taken away from this book, or from the ideas that you are trying to grasp. And concentration gets scattered. Even if you are sitting there, and if you are pressing the chair with your hands, the sense of touch, tugindriya, the sense of touch and mind come together, and you become aware of that chair. So, a part of concentration power is always lost. Now, In yoga, our attempt is to concentrate all the powers of the mind on what we are doing. That's where we are able to remember. So if you read a book or listen to something with extreme concentration, it registers that impression in the mind and you won't forget it. When we are interested in something, then we are able to remember that because mind is not being distracted by the senses. For a yogi, he tries to withdraw his mind from all the objects around. So in his case, there is no distraction. When he reads a book, his whole mind is here. He doesn't become aware of the vehicle passing the road, or the sight in or the visual object in front of him, or the smell that may be coming from the adjoining room. He is not aware of it. Whole mind is concentrated on what he is reading. Now, for the beginner, his mind is normally distracted in all directions. For an advanced spiritual aspirant, seeker, mind is not distracted like this. So there are two terms used here. One is Aruruksu. Aruruksu is one who is trying to enter spiritual life, who is trying to ascend the path leading to spiritual enlightenment, spiritual illumination. That person is called in Sanskrit Aruruksu. Means who has somebody who has a strong desire to enter the path leading to spiritual enlightenment. Arudha is a person who has already become well established in this, well established in yoga. Now, the Gita says, for a spiritual seeker who has just entered spiritual journey, whose mind is normally distracted towards different objects, mind being dragged to different external objects, what should that spiritual seeker do? He cannot deliberately withdraw his senses of perception from external objects. You know, even if he tried to physically withdraw senses of perception from external objects, mentally we cannot do that. If you keep your eyes closed, you are trying to withdraw eyes from external objects. You don't see them. But mentally you will be see external objects. And seeing mentally is not very different from seeing physically, so far as the impression or distraction is concerned. So for a beginner, he should let his senses work actively, let him keep his senses active, but he should not be attached to either the work or the results of the work. If he is completely free from attachment, mind will not be distracted, or mental distraction will decrease slowly. He will be able to concentrate more and more. So, this sloka is very important for every spiritual seeker. If you are a beginner in spiritual life, don't remain inactive. Remain active, mean be engaged in good actions, positive actions, but without any obsession for the results, without being obsessed with what that work can do. What result that work can produce. Keep your mind away from any attachment towards the work and also its results. So this is the first instruction. Second instruction is very simple. For an advanced spiritual person, he is completely free from distractions. So for him, his senses are established in quietude, in perfect equanimity, he is always calm and quiet. He is free from any distraction. So two paths are, two methods are described here. For a beginner, he should never remain inactive, because inaction is an invitation to trouble. If he remains active, his senses will get engaged in different activities. But at the same time, if he practices non-attachment, the activities will produce good results, but he will not be, he can be free from all entanglements. On the other hand, if a beginner tries to achieve spiritual enlightenment through inaction, inaction can itself become, it can become a source of trouble. Because even if your senses are completely free from action, if you are completely inactive, mind can become hyperactive. Because in spiritual life, memories, impressions, tendencies, attitudes, all will start working at the internal level. They create much greater problems than external action. That's why the teacher of Gita says, for a beginner, action is a must. On the other hand, for a yogi who is well established in spiritual life, he naturally becomes tranquil, peaceful. There is no deliberate effort behind it. For a spiritual seeker who is established in yoga, his mind is naturally calm and quiet. There is no deliberate effort to withdraw senses from external objects. A very famous verse, which is quoted again and again in all books, all important books related to Vedantic way of life. This is the third verse. Then there is a fifth verse. Those of you who can remember the Gita, you can find the first verse which I quoted, comes in the sixth chapter. It is the third verse. Chapter 6, where Lord Krishna divides spiritual seekers into two groups, the beginners and the advanced group. The beginners should never remain deliberately inactive, because inaction becomes a source of trouble. Inaction is an invitation to negative thoughts, tendencies, and impressions, which can create conflicts the moment you start to meditate. The moment you start meditating, immediately these negative tendencies, impressions and images, memories will come to the surface. Because you remained inactive for a long time, because mind was distracted, those different external objects, and these senses have brought so many negative thought currents into mind, so mind will face a terrible conflict.
May I ask a question?
Just a minute. We will have a question answer session.
Oh.
From 9 to 9:30.
Okay.
No, yes, no, sorry, 8:30 to 9. We will have a session, class, up to 8 o'clock. From 8 o'clock to 8:30, meditation, 8:30 to 9. We will have question and answer session. You are most welcome to put your questions. Yes, I get it. Okay. This is, so now we will come to the fifth verse. The fifth verse in the sixth chapter. This is also very famous. Uddhare dātmana ātmāna na ātmāna avasādi ātmaiva khyātmano vantuhu ātmaiva vipurātmana. Now here, Lord Krishna is going deeper into human mind. You know, there are two levels of psychological function. One, you may call it lower self and you may call it higher self. In a general way. Well, we can analyze the subject from another angle. Mind, as we normally call it, a set of emotions, sometimes called, can be called mind and intellect. Now, suppose we are reading a great book, we are listening to great talk, we are listening to some noble ideas which have a stimulating effect on spiritual life. We have a strong desire. Well, this is something which I must practice. And this is something which I must experiment with. If anyone who has a little inclination for spiritual life will have a strong desire to practice some of these ideas, some of the noble spiritual ideas that you find in a book when you're reading it. But then when you try to practice it, you find mind poses a number of problems and conflicts. That's why everyone wants to lead a good life, more or less, except hardened criminals. Even among people who normally commit things which we call criminal activities, there is, at least in many of them, there is an inherent desire, if possible, to be free from all this wrongdoing. Now, of course, that is not the subject here. The idea discussed here is closely related to spiritual life. You shall read the translation, then you shall explain. The translation is something like this. One should always uplift one's lower self by the higher self. One should not depress or downgrade oneself. For self is both friend and also enemy of the self. Next verse also should be read together. I shall read that sixth verse and I shall read translation. Then I will explain both fifth and sixth verse elaborately. Bandhuratmaatmanastasya enatmeivatmanajitaha anatmanastu shatrutve varteid atmeiva shatruvat. That's first and sixth verse. Sorry, fifth and sixth verse. Translation is this. To him who has subdued the sober self, the lower self, by the higher self, the self acts like a friend. But to him who has lost his higher self by the dominance of the lower one, the self functions as the enemy, always hostile to him. The idea is this. Our mind is our best friend and our mind is our worst enemy also, depending upon how we react to our own mind. Now, if we allow our mind to be dragged, to be distracted by fleeting objects of desire, lower desires all the time, which are natural to any biological being. And if we don't make any effort to elevate the lower mind to a higher level, with the help of good ideas, noble ideas, from books or from lectures or spiritual practices, then what happens? The lower mind becomes our worst enemy. If somehow, if we can elevate the lower mind to the higher level, then mind becomes your best friend. Now, this can be analyzed from another angle, as I said at the beginning. Well, we may say mind, the lower self or lower mind is a bundle of emotions, natural human responses to external stimuli, desires, impressions, objects of desire, which naturally produce in mind a desire to enjoy all external things. When you are completely under the power of temptations of external desire. This is lower mind. Now, if such a person becomes a spiritual seeker, he may also try to read some good books, talk to people from whom he can hear spiritual ideas, or somehow he may come in contact with spiritually elevating ideas. It's possible by any media, either print media, electronic media, by listening to good talks or anything. So, within the personality, there are two forces. One, the higher self. which listens to spiritual talks, which tries to, which has a desire to practice those spiritual ideas. And if possible, to grow in spiritual life. And therefore, you try to, one may try to meditate, one may try to contemplate in spiritual ideas. Then suddenly the mind, the lower mind, brings it, it comes to the surface. In fact, it throws up conflicting ideas, conflicting tendencies. Oh, what's the use of all this? Or sometimes, you know, it can, the temptation or problems can take the form of an undesirable person coming and telling you, well, these spiritual ideas are absolutely trash, well, you better enjoy this world. It can be that way. It can take the form of visible human temptation also. Whatever may be, these two forces are always working. In fact, Mahatma Gandhi used to refer to this in his Anasakti Yoga. Gandhiji says, Gandhiji, apart from being a great political leader, was himself some kind of a spiritual experimentalist. He subjected his own life to spiritual experiments. So, and he was not actually, he was not really a Sanskrit scholar. He was not even a philosopher. He himself admits. The book he himself wrote was written with the help of one of his followers, Vinoba Bhave, who was himself a Sanskrit scholar. So Gandhiji says that whenever he faced any conflicts or any emotional problems, psychological depression, he used to read Bhagavad Gita. Some of these verses which I've mentioned, the sixth verse, see. Your mind is your best friend if it is free from the entanglements of external objects. If it is your best friend. But your mind is the worst enemy. It will drag you to the lowest abyss of self-destruction if that mind is a slave of senses. So if a mind is slave of senses, it is the worst enemy. If the mind is master of senses, then it is the best friend. It becomes friend, guide, friend and philosopher. Now what the teacher of Gita says is this. One should always try to bridge the gap between the lower mind and the higher mind. Higher mind you may call buddhi. You can call buddhi means intellect. By intellect I don't mean cognitive faculty as it is called in educational psychology. I mean, intellect which is refined intellect. An intellect which tells you, let me read some good books, let me listen to some good noble spiritual ideas, let me try to practice it. This is the intellect, buddhi, refined intellect, enlightened intellect. This is the higher self, the lower, I mean, the higher mind. Now, the lower mind, as I said earlier, is something else. It is a slave of the senses. Every minute, every second, it is distracted, it is dragged towards external objects by the senses. I already gave the example of five creatures. There is a great verse in one of the classics in Vedanta. The verse is this. Shabdadri panjabhireva panja panjatumapusa gunena baddhaha kuranga madanga padanga meenaha bringa nara panjabhiranjitakim. Here is a clear, a graphic description of the lower self, lower mind, a mind which is slave of the senses. The verse tells us this. You think of a forest, different animals are there. Now, the verse tells us, there are deers, there are elephants, and then the verse also refers to fish and some insects which move from flower to flower, flower plant to flower plant. The verse tells us, say a hunter tries to catch deer. He plays on his flute. And listening to this music, the deer comes out of its cave where it is hiding, bush, and then it is shot by an arrow, it is killed. So the deer is killed because of the temptation of ears, one of the senses of perception. And elephants, they move in herds, they touch each other. So they lose their direction and they fall in a pit, which may be dug by elephant poachers and people who catch elephants to enslave them, or maybe to kill them for ivory. And then there is another type of creature which moves from flower plant to flower plant. It is attracted by the perfume, the sweet smell of rose plants. At that time the creature, the insect, may be killed by bigger insects. And then fish may be attracted by the bait, the smell of bait. And when he eats the bait, fish is caught and killed. And again there are certain creatures, you know, moths. During rainy season, moths, thousands of moths spring up. When they see a blazing fire, they are drawn towards it. They think this is something very wonderful to see, the effulgence of blazing fire. So they are dragged by the eyes and they also get killed. Now, the author of this verse, Shankaracharya, puts a question: what to speak of the fate of a human being who is every minute simultaneously dragged, distracted by all the five senses together at a time? Because in the case of human being, all the five senses are trying to drag the mind to its external objects. Now that lower mind, which is dragged by external objects, which is slave of senses, is the lower self. Then there is another mind which becomes active in the morning and evening when you try to meditate. At least the mind which tells you, which tells us, we must, let us meditate. That is a higher mind. A mind which suggests, let us go and read a good book, listen to a spiritually elevating music, or a spiritually elevating painting, or anything which brings us a spiritually elevating, stimulating idea. It takes the mind away from the tyranny of senses. That's a higher mind. Now, here the teacher of Gita tells us, never allow your mind to be dragged by the five senses. Never allow the higher mind, the mind which is helpful in spiritual life, to be dragged down by the lower mind towards fleeting objects of physical sensual pleasures. That is the instruction of this. If the mind becomes a slave of the senses, that mind is the worst enemy that we can ever have. If the mind is free from the tyranny of the senses, that mind is the best friend. Most help. That mind will guide us, take us in the proper direction. So that is the essence of these fifth and sixth verses. Now, there is a statement, a famous verse, that this is the 10th verse, 10th, 11th, 12th verses, and 13 and 14. These verses are very important for meditative life. In fact, they give us some practical instructions on how we must practice spirituality, meditation, contemplation, and so on. 10th verse is Yogi Yunjita Saladam Atman Dehasisthidaha Ekaki Yadachitta Atman Nirashihi Aparigraha. The 10th verse of the 6th chapter. The idea is this: a yogi should always practice spiritual communion, residing alone in a solitary spot, without any desire, without any obsession, any sense of feeling that this belongs to me, any kind of obsessive attachment towards anything, and it should be disciplined body and mind. This is the literal translation. But I shall explain this. First, it says you must practice yoga. Here yoga means meditation in a solitary place. Solitariness is not necessarily physical solitariness. Because even if you sit in a room which is where there is nobody else, you are in perfect solitude. But if mind is ready, if the mind is not ready, then there will be no solitude. You cannot enjoy solitude. So solitude is a psychological condition, mental condition. At a higher level, it's a spiritual condition. So one should try to meditate in a place which is helpful for spiritual life. See, an advanced yogi can feel this solitude and quietude even in a marketplace, because his mind is completely under his control. His mind is not a slave of the senses. Therefore, his mind is free from any kind of distractions. See, if he wants to meditate, or if he wants to read a book, or if he wants to think of something, he can do that even in the midst of a crowd, in an airport, anywhere, for an advanced spiritual seeker. But for a beginner, he should try to make use of external conditions, places which are more or less free from crowds and distractions, environments where one can sit in quietude, where nature, external nature and environment itself becomes helpful in creating a sense of quietude and solitude within us. Therefore, the verse tells us that a beginner should try to meditate, contemplate alone, sitting somewhere alone. Because in a crowd, what happens? Our mind will naturally be distracted towards external, to the presence of friends and companions and fellow seekers. That is why congregational prayer is good, but congregational prayer is not enough for spiritual growth. The spiritual growth is an inward journey. You are turning your movement inward. And therefore, and not only that, behind this meditative process, there is a strong conviction that within us there is the supreme consciousness that we call Atman, which is the immanent reality, which is the omnipresent reality, the all-pervading reality, which is a transcendent reality, which is one, and it is present in every living being. Not only living beings, but the entire creation is an expression of the Divine Spirit. So there is nothing in this world where the Divine Consciousness is not present. It is present as an immanent reality. Therefore, every spiritual practice actually a kind of inward journey. It is not an investigation in the external world. It is an inquiry into internal reality. And this is possible only if you can feel solitude. That's why prayer becomes meaningful if it is done in solitude. That is the idea behind. Therefore, in this verse, there are some very important, striking statements here. It rehasisthirayasa means actually, literally means can be secretiveness or solitude, where you are alone. There is no companion. Because then only prayer, meditation, or spiritual practices become effective. Because we are, as I said, we are traveling inward. We are moving inward. It's a spiritual journey towards one's own reality. It's a kind of homeward journey, an attempt to realize our own true nature. Therefore, one should be alone. And this is true of not only meditation, it is also true of prayer also. Prayer also becomes sincere, effective, when it is done in perfect solitude. That's the idea behind it. And there are two terms here in Sanskrit language. Ekaki means one who is alone. Alone in the sense, it's not that somebody is left out in loneliness, not in that sense. If he is able to enjoy, one who is able to enjoy the condition of being alone, then only he becomes a spiritual aspirant. You should not feel miserable when he is alone. If a spiritual seeker feels miserable when he is alone, then he should better, instead of meditating, he should chant some holy names, he should sing hymns, glories of the Lord, or he can read spiritually elevating books loudly, if he or she is afraid of quietude or solitude. So a true spiritual seeker should be able to enjoy quietude and solitude. He should consider it as a blessing. Then what happens? Then spiritual journey begins. So these two terms are very important terms in spiritual life. And then there is the 11th verse or 6th chapter. Shuchavudese pradishthapya sthiramasanam atmanaha na atyuchudam na dinijam chailajana kushottaram tatraigagram manakrutva yadachitendriya kriha ubavishyasine yujya yogam atma visuddhaye etc. There are a few terms are used here which are very relevant. I shall explain in English. So first, any spiritual seeker who wants to meditate should seek a clean spot, a place where he or she will be free from any kind of disturbing thoughts. See, a place where there is a foul smell, you won't be able to meditate. A place which is dirty, you won't be able to meditate. Remember, if you are an advanced yogi, you can meditate anywhere. You don't have to seek a solitary place. Every place becomes solitary for you. Because even when you are in the midst of a crowd, a stampede, if you are a yogi, if you are an advanced spiritual seeker, you can enjoy your own company. Because you feel, I am one with the Supreme Consciousness within me. But that is for an advanced soul. But a beginner should try to take care of certain external factors, a clean place. And that place should not be too high or too low, is mentioned here. Generally, too high a place, again, it can cause disturbance. You may, suppose you're sitting somewhere on an elevator platform, you feel that it may fall. If it is lower level, that also will create. It should be medium place. Remember, these are all instructions for a beginner. But a beginner should take care of all this. And then, of course, here an instruction with regard to how you must prepare your seat on which you sit. But this is optional. Modern times, one may not be able to fully put this into action. A seat should be made with kusha grass spread over the skin and the clothing. You know, that you have to remember, this idea originated at least around 3000-4000 BC, you have to remember. So in those days, these ingredients were available in the Himalayan regions, in the hermitages of those places. But in today's world, you cannot fully practice this. So one should prepare a clean, a neat place and a seat also. A seat on which one should be able to sit. This is the simple idea behind. Many factors are important. For example, you should be a clean place. You should be free from foul smell. Anything which is stimulating the senses. And it should not be a dangerous place, like to an elevated platform or anything. So all these factors can be taken into consideration into these conditions. But certain minor details with regard to how you should form a proper seat, that those things can be optional. One can choose a proper clean seat. And then, so these are some of the conditions. And the 13th verse gives a very important, and that is very practical. Samam kaya shirogrivam dhare najaram sthiraga samprekshan asigagram sum disascha anavalokayan prashantatma vigada vig brahmachari pradisthidaha manasamyamyam achittu yukta asidamatra. I have just read the verse for those who are interested. You can refer, those who are interested, you can refer 13th and 14th verses of 6th chapter. So I have tried to read and outline, give an outline of this verse, 10th to 14th verses of 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, if you remember. You can read English translation. Now, one important condition that is mentioned here, and that is accepted in all meditative postures, not only in Vedantic tradition, but also not in Hindu or Vedantic tradition, but also in Buddhist tradition. You should keep the body, head and neck erect. That is one thing. There is a physiological reason for this. You can remain yourself alert only when you keep your spinal cord on a straight. If you are bent forward or backward, attention can be distracted. But remember, these are some essential conditions for somebody who starts spiritual practice. That's a point to remember. If you have seen the picture of Ramana Maharshi and a few great saints, you find then they are not always sitting on the straight line. But for them, you know, every posture is equally helpful. Even there are great sages and saints who can meditate, who can remain in a meditative mood, even they are laying down. That's all. But then for a beginner, all these conditions are important because mind remains alert. And again, if one is perpetually in a crooked physical posture, it can be tiring because one should be able to sit on a posture for a long time and in a very relaxed mood. These two conditions are very important according to Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. So Patanjali describes, he defines the correct, appropriate posture for meditation, sukham sthiram asana. The idea is this, you should be able to sit in that posture for a long time. At the same time, you should be able to sit in that posture for a long time with perfect relaxation. Then only that person can be said to be established in meditative posture. Yogasanas can help us, but too much of obsession with yogic postures can take our mind more towards physical health and physical comforts and take the mind away from spiritual ideas. It doesn't always happen, but there is a possibility. But once we remember this, we keep this idea in mind, we can avoid it. But yogic postures are certainly helpful to acquire that level of physical fitness which is necessary for you to sit with body, head and neck erect. At the same time, should be in a relaxed mood. Some people, I've seen, they try to meditate all muscles flexed. There's a lot of effort involved. And within a very short time, they get tired and exhausted. So, their erectness of body posture, head, neck and body, they are still, but then they get tired. So, body, head and neck should be in straight posture. Spinal cord should be kept straight. But there should be no effort involved in remaining in that posture. It should become be very natural, very smooth, and it should be in perfect, in a perfect relaxed condition. So that is one. And another important point mentioned here is, if you read this verse, you find one should not look around. We should look straight. But if you look straight, all the visual objects that come to your eyes, I mean that you happen to see, can be a distraction for the mind. Mind will be distracted towards these external visual objects. So to avoid the problem, one should keep the eyes open, not fully open, at the same time be free from external, the influence, the distraction of external objects. For that, the teacher of Gita makes a point here. You should be gazing at the tip of the nose. You find in the transition, you find. But actually, one should not gaze at the tip of the nose. Shankaracharya, the great commentator of this Gita, says, as if, because you should keep your eyes open, but it should not be wide open. If the eyes are kept wide open, external objects will distract your mind. You won't be able to sit for a long time. Because the moment your mind is distracted, body will start moving in some direction or other. And unless mind is kept away from distraction, you won't be able to keep the body straight. Any distraction, mental distraction, will result in some kind of movement of the body, shaking either one sideways or backwards, some kind of something. On the other hand, if one is able to fully concentrate on some inner principle, inner idea, the body can remain quiet, straight, you know, without distraction. So the great commentator Shankaracharya has given a very, very important, very profound psychological principle, suggestion. You should not be staring or looking at the tip of the nose, but as if, means eyes should be kept, you can see Swami Vivekananda's picture, you can see, eyes should be kept in such a condition as if they are concentrated, gazing at the tip of the nose, but actually should not be, half closed eyes. You won't see your own tip of the nose, of course you can't see that. But at the same time, if you keep the eyes in that position, it won't see external objects. And if it doesn't see external objects, mind won't be dragged by external objects or distractions, and mind will remain calm and quiet and concentrated, body also remain calm and quiet. This is not possible for a wrestler or a gymnastic to do that. For that, one's mind should be trained. Then only one can be relaxed and be able to sit for a long time. You should be able to sit for a long time. At the same time, you should feel a kind of a feeling of complete restfulness. Meditation is the most profound condition of mental restfulness. You feel completely relaxed and restful. So these are some of the very famous instructions contained in the Gita. And another one is, you know, you should not be looking either direction, either sideways or forward or anything. So this is you can see the profoundness of this instruction. Eyes should be kept in such a position as if they are gazing at the tip of the nose, but actually not. Shankaracharya makes the point clear in his commentary. Should not be gazing, then your tip of the nose will be the object of your concentration. It should not happen. Nothing should become the object of your eyes. Eyes should be completely free from any visual object. So that's the idea behind it. And then one should not look in either direction. This is Chanavaloka. Its meaning is you should not look sideways, either to the left or towards the right or towards any objects. But there again, one important suggestion which I gave in the last class that is very relevant, a strong desire to practice meditation will help us to minimize distractions. Distractions always result from a lack of strong desire for spiritual enlightenment. See, generally, if you have a sincere desire for anything, you naturally get great concentration power in that particular area of your interests. So one important suggestion given by spiritual teachers is one should have a very strong, concentrated desire for spiritual enlightenment. And then you should be calm and quiet. And this becomes, meditative posture becomes natural. It should become natural. It should not be the result of an effort. But for a beginner, he should try to practice this. He may have to put up an effort for this, for attaining this posture. But gradually, it becomes natural for anyone. Posture of the body is considered to be very important in meditation. Because if one meditates for a long time with body in a crooked condition, he may develop back pain, headache, and so on. That's the idea. That's why the body, when it is kept straight and for a long time, and in relaxed mood, it gets great. It starts feeling of great restfulness. Complete relaxation. Then there are a few important suggestions in the 16th and 17th verse of the 6th chapter. Na atyasnadastu yogosti na jayganta manasnataha na atisotna silasya jagrido naivacha arjuna yukta ahara vikarasya yukta chestasya karmasu yukta supna avabodhasya yogo bhavati dukha. I have not just read in random, but I shall explain in detail. In the 16th verse, the Gita tells us, real success or progress in Gita is possible only for those who practice moderation in eating. If you are eating too much, it can be a distraction, because stomach will revolt. If you don't eat anything, then also stomach will revolt. Means, any kind of distraction coming from the body should be avoided. And not only this is to be avoided, not only from a physical point of view, but also from a psychological point of view. In some of the advanced books, it is mentioned, if a spiritual seeker practices extreme rigidity, extreme asceticism, fasting too much, it can be a distraction for meditation, spiritual life. Unless that person is an advanced soul. You have seen people who are beginners practicing some asceticism. Say, I'm a great ascetic, and these people are all eating too much food all the time. That feeling comes to the person. And that person cannot practice contentment. Because if a beginner practices too much of asceticism, he becomes conscious of the fact, he becomes proud of the fact that he is practicing asceticism. That also is a great distraction. See, I'm very austere, others are all, see, that feeling. It can be a great distraction. So, in the Buddhist scriptures, Lord Buddha also has stated the same ideas, in the Lord Krishna also. That is why in the 17th verse it says, you know, one should practice perfect moderation. Neither feasting nor fasting. But food is, food should be considered to be a necessary factor for keeping the body healthy so that we can go beyond body consciousness. Because all spiritual practices aim at going beyond body consciousness. So anything which leads to distraction by the body should be avoided. If one fasts too much, then, and if he's just a beginner, then hunger will remind him of body, of the existence of the body. Body tells him, well, I'm hungry, I'm here. So mind is distracted by body consciousness. If he feasts, if he enjoys too much of food, if he eats too much of food, that also can create the same kind of distraction for the mind. All spiritual practices aim at going beyond body, transcending the body. So to be able to transcend the body, you should be, we must try to be away from the temptations of the body. So if one practices extreme asceticism, and if that person is not an advanced yogi, then extreme asceticism will make him conscious of his body. Hunger also will make him aware of the existence of the body. So he may be meditating upon food instead of Atman or Supreme Consciousness. The same thing happens if he eats too much. So eating too much and too little, both should be avoided. Moderation in food, in all kinds of activities, is an essential factor for any spiritual seeker. We'll continue this in the next class, and then we have, I think we have two more classes. We'll try to cover that portion. Later we'll show to yoga philosophy, yoga practice. So we'll have meditation for half an hour, and after that we'll have interaction, question and answer session. Om, peace, peace.
I just wanted to see if this whole thing can be looked with a different perspective. We should come to the firm conviction that mind is the root cause of all this trouble. There is no such thing as a mind control, because to control the mind, a part of mind will try to control the other one. So we are saying essentially we have two minds, which is not true. Third, the mind is all full of delusion. It has no substance, and it cannot function beyond time, space and causation. So what knowledge we have so far accumulated, and what we call, you know, mind, is not the truth. Now, as I said, that annihilation of the mind is the thing to do, not the control. It should be just wiped away once and for all. And in order to do that, we have to look at the way it works. During meditation, you know, a thought comes, then we recognize it, then we decide and we sit on the judgment and say whether it is good or bad. And that's where, you know, the disturbance comes. If on the other hand...
Okay, it's clear. Now shall I try to focus on some of the points you raised right now? Because the point is clear. Now shall I focus?
No, I have not finished yet. I just need a few minutes.
Yes.
So we are the ones who react to that thought. You know, the thought itself has no substance as such. And that creates all these problems of agitation, disturbance and all. And we should know that we really don't know anything in truth about this universe. not a particle. Even a particle is a mystery to us. So we cannot sit on judgment and say this is good or bad. So we should not react to the thought that comes into the mind. What happens is just, you know, it will just keep coming and it will slowly fade away and go for good. It will not reappear because, you know, it has no support to perpetuate itself. Or another thing is...
No, I shall answer this because it should not become a talk. This point I shall... Then we can continue this particular aspect. The one point you mentioned that is very important, annihilation of mind. This idea is very important, and in Buddhist religion, especially in Vijnanavada and Shunyavada, this idea is carried to an extreme point from a metaphysical point of view. Where, according to Vedanta, mind is not something to be annihilated. Mind is just a form of vrittis, impressions. Vrittis function at four different levels. Vrittis means tendencies or impressions. One level is mind, the first one. When we speculate on something of which we are not very sure, from a distance. See, if suppose you see an object from a distance, we are not very sure what that object is, then our mind is functioning. One, you may have different ideas with regard to what an object is, but we are not very sure as to what it is. This is one type of function of human impressions according to Vedanta. And this function is called mind, manovritti. The second one, because I am coming to the subject, because Vedanta also believes in annihilation of mind, but Vedanta believes in merging of mind in Atman. Merging of mental vrittis or mind manovrittis or tendencies in Atman. That is what Vedanta says. I am taking the Vedanti point of view. In fact, in a way, both approaches are the same, but from two different angles. Now, when I come to a decision as to what that object is, it is intellect, buddhi. When I identify that object as something which I have seen earlier, last week, then it is memory. When I identify myself as the one who has seen it, it is aham. Okay, I am not coming to that. Now, Vedanta ultimately aims at cessation of mental vrittis. So, instead of using the word annihilation, when these vrittis completely stop, then we reach the Supreme Goal. The cessation is the word which Vedanta uses, and that is also yoga. Yogaha chitta vritti nirodha. That is the first sutra of Yoga Sutras with regard to this. So, cessation of mental impressions or tendencies is what is meant by mind control. I mentioned this point many times earlier. There is no such thing as mind control. Diverting mind towards positive, good, spiritually helpful ideas, and then ultimately when we reach the goal, you find we have transcended the mind. So, merging of mind in Atman. The moment you go beyond all tendencies and impressions, then we have transcended the mind. When you are at mental level, you are not aware of the fact that you are Supreme Consciousness or Atman. When you become aware of the reality that you are the Supreme Consciousness, that there is no mind. So Ramana Maharshi, in one sentence, puts this in a very classic statement, which Arthur Osborne, who was an American disciple of Ramana Maharshi, projected on many of his writings. He said, mind turned inward is Atman. Mind turned outward is mind. That is Ramana Maharshi. And you know, Ramana Maharshi was not what you call a philosopher. His method was, analyze, see the world, look around, and who am I, who is experiencing all this? And then through this introspection, we realize I am the supreme reality, the consciousness, the immanent principle, and also the omnipresent principle. So Ramana Maharshi makes a very interesting statement as you know, when you turn mind inward, it is Atman. In fact, when you turn your mind inward, there is no mind. Because mind is mind only so long as it is turned outward. Mind is name of a set of mental impressions and tendencies when these impressions and tendencies are projected outward. The moment mind is withdrawn from this, it is no more mind. In Buddhist, in the Vijnanavada and Shunyavada, one is called the doctrine of emptiness, the other is subjective idealism. In both these schools, mind is closely studied. Of course, Vijnanavada is called mind chittam. According to them, according to the two schools, so I won't go into those details, all the objects in the world exist only so long as I am seeing those objects. External objects have no independent status. They don't have the status of reality. They are momentary. So long as I am seeing this, it exists. So when the moment I cease to see this, it no longer exists for me. So what is this? It is nothing but an impression of this object. This object is nothing but an impression that this object creates in my chittam or mind. The moment my mind is turned away, it no longer exists. This is Vijnanavada. Shunyavada, according to Shunyavada doctrine of the philosophy of emptiness, the moment we realize a complete, what is called annihilation of tendencies and vasanas, we realize that emptiness. And it is called, sometimes it is called annihilation of tendencies of vasanas. But Vedantins put one question. Who is the experiencer who enjoys this experience of cessation of tendencies and vasanas? I can reject, I can annihilate all the tendencies, impressions in my mind. But then, still in my mind, there's a feeling, when I'm completely free from all conflicting thoughts and tendencies, I feel a kind of inner joy, blissfulness. Who is, and what is that real, that subject who enjoys this blissfulness? And according to Vedanta, it is Atman, Supreme Consciousness. So there should be a subject who enjoys the state of blissfulness when you experience annihilation of mind or annihilation of tendencies. If there is no subject, then it goes against logic. So, in doctrine of emptiness, which believes in annihilation of tendencies or mind, there is no clear answer to this point. This is like there's a long debate on this point in medieval times. I won't go into those details. Please.
So Swami, the recommendation for those of us who don't have that kind of control of our mind and senses to get there is that we continue to act, and we act with non-attachment.
Yes.
And then are we attempting to substitute what our senses are drawn to with spiritual food instead?
Well, you know, what we do for a beginner is to divert the natural tendencies of the senses to creative, constructive, positive channels so that their natural activities will bring positive ideas, which will reduce the power of negative ideas. And that will help us in spiritual life. So, as I said, we cannot mentally withdraw senses. Physically we can do, because mentally we'll be active. That is something we, that is some, that is a stage that we have to go beyond. And it is possible only when we divert the senses into creative channels, and through that positive when mind is enriched with positive ideas, and then these positive ideas will turn the mind to a higher level, spirituality. I shall give you an example. Well, suppose, well, if you are interested in reading books, let us read good books, spiritually elevating books. And these books will bring good ideas to our mind. Now, when we try to meditate, when we practice any kind of introspection, these ideas which we have gathered from good books or good, I mean, interactions, will come to the surface. Negative ideas also will come, conflictive ideas will come. But if positive ideas get stronger and stronger, richer and richer, negative ideas will get weaker. And those negative ideas are spiritually helpful, spiritually stimulating. So naturally, it will encourage and help us in our spiritual journey. This is the recommendation given to the beginner. As I suggested earlier, there is no such thing as controlling of the senses. Diverting or channelizing or diverting these senses towards creative channels. That is the suggestion given by teachers.
Thank you, Swami.
The senses are activated by the mind itself.
Yes.
So during sleep, when the mind is inactive, there are no action in the senses.
Yes. Senses, but you know, Gita makes a statement that is very important, you know. Senses are activated by mind, but it works in both ways. See, there is a sloka, Dhyayato Vishayantum Saha Sangasteshu Vajayade Sangasanjayade Krama Kama Krodho Vijayade Krodhat Bhavadi Sammoha Sammoha Smriti Vibhramaha Smriti Bhramsha Buddhinasu Buddhinasa Pranashari. I shall explain in English. The second chapter, you know, there is a very interesting description. It is true that mind activates the senses. It is also true that senses activate the mind. Because what really happens when there are external objects around us, for a person who is not spiritually advanced, senses will bring some ideas related to external objects to mind. So senses will work upon mind, and mind, if it is not under control, if it has got a tendency to be dragged into those undesirable objects, then mind will allow itself to be dragged by the senses towards those objects. For a spiritually elevated person whose mind is naturally drawn towards spiritual ideas, senses cannot function. But for a beginner whose mind is normally distracted towards external objects, senses will drag the mind to external objects. So they work upon each other. For an advanced soul, external objects cannot work upon his mind. For a beginner, it works both ways.
Under hypnosis, a certain sensation can be stopped from the mind.
Hypnosis sometimes, it works only at temporary level.
As long as he's under...
See, regression, for example, I know certain cases, you see, children or people suffering from phobia, psychological problems related to some childhood experiences. But patients, psychiatric patients, may not be aware of these things. At the conscious level, the patient doesn't remember certain things happened to him. But at the subconscious level, those memories are very strong. And these memories can create phobia. So psychiatrists may use hypnotism. and we'll try to bring him, bring his memory back to his childhood experiences. And once the patient is able to recognize in a hypnotized state, the phobia can vanish. But it is not an absolute cure. It can recur also. But in some cases, it can vanish. This with regard to hypnotism. But in certain cases, which of course some people may or may not believe, Edgar cases, parapsychological cases, you find problems and memories related to previous life will have a greater impact in curing problems. So there are many psychological problems, phobia, melancholia, and so on, which cannot be explained in the light of experiences belonging to this life. In such cases, some experimental psychologists and parapsychologists have tried to cross the borderline and take the patient into previous life. Of course, this is again, you know, this branch of psychology is not accepted as psychology proper by scientists, but most of them do admit that such things do exist. So when patients are suffering from problems related to experiences in this world, they can be brought to a memory level where they recollect name and form, both of those experiences. But when patients are brought to previous life experiences, they remember ideas, but they don't remember names and forms. So mysterious problems are sometimes cured. That is true. But then, this is not an absolute cure. But whatever may be, whether hypnotism or any branch of knowledge, mind functions only in the form of flow of ideas, memories, tendencies and impressions. That's how mind functions. Same as vritti. See, sankalpa vikalpatmika antakarna vritti hi manaha. This is the definition given in Vedanta. This is definition may appear to be very superficial. I shall explain in English. See, ideas which may be positive or negative, mutually conflicting ideas arising in mind, tendencies, impressions, and when they function in a particular velocity and wavelength, it is called mind. So mind is nothing but just a flow of memories, tendencies and impressions. You can never turn these memories and impressions towards one's own inner life, because generally these impressions are related to external things. Even if you remember experiences or objects which we are not seeing in front of us, even if you remember, still they are based on external experiences. So mind can never be turned inward. So all the tendencies that occur at mental level are related to experiences involving external objects. Five senses creating all kinds of memories, all kinds of impressions, bringing all of them into mind. So mind is a bundle of these tendencies and impressions.
As Dr. Ramakrishna said, that the impure mind and pure mind is Atman.
Yes, so that's the idea.
For sadhakas, for aspirants, for what is needed is, the mind is impure, that is ego.
Yes.
The mind is pure is Atman. So all our effort is to make this make bigger, more and purer and purer and purer. That is the aim. When the mind becomes pure, it is not called the mind anymore.
Yes, that's right. When mind becomes pure, what does it mean? It should be free from all tendencies and vrittis and impressions.
Of course.
That means then it's no more mind. It's no more mind. When mind is free from all impressions and tendencies, it is no more mind. In Vedanta and Yoga, there are terms used for this Amani Bhava, etc. I'm not going to choose things. So, annihilation of mind and turning the mind towards Atman is practically the same. At the experience level, two terms are used in two systems of philosophy. One is Buddhism and also in Vedanta. Two. Vocabulary and language style of expressions may differ, but the content is the same.
Can you explain the concept of the three gunas to me?
Sattva guna, rajo guna, tamo guna. That you want me to explain?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, generally, human character or nature in a broad sense consists of these three gunas. Sattva guna, rajo guna and tamo guna. Sattva guna is, sattva guna indicates knowledge and light. Knowledge and light. Now that means, but this translated into human character, you mean all kinds, all good human or good qualities of human being. Knowledge and light. Light here, the Sanskrit term is jyoti. It means something which reveals to you. Again, as knowledge, the same idea. Rajoguna indicates activity, action. Tamoguna indicates ignorance, sleepishness, inertia, etc. Generally, every human being has got these three characteristics. According to Gita, one should always try to aim at reaching sattva guna. When you reach sattva guna, you have already transcended both tamo guna and also rajo guna. But one can reach sattva guna only after going through rajo guna. From ignorance, inertia and inaction, one should raise himself to the level of action and dynamism. And then, at the next stage, he should go beyond action and dynamism. Going beyond, transcending, not going against. A person established in sattva guna need not necessarily be inactive. He is not inactive. He is capable of tremendous activity, but he can go beyond the attachment, the entanglement related to rajo guna. A person who is dominated by rajo guna will have tremendous ambition, tremendous zeal, efficiency, and a strong desire, strong attachment to what he is doing and also to what results his action can bring. Every action he does creates a strong impression in his mind. So he gets depressed, sometimes he becomes very active, very dynamic and so on. Swing different moods. The same person, when he goes beyond this level, when he gets established in sattva guna, he retains his ability to work with the same level of efficiency. But he goes beyond it. I shall give an example. There are some people who tell you, I can never keep quiet for a minute. I'm always active. It's a typical characteristic of rajo guna. On the other hand, there are people who can be very quiet, but be very active. There are some people who are even physically very active, but very quiet and calm. So, sattva guna goes beyond, it transcends rajo guna, but it doesn't go against action or dynamism. Tamoguna is the absence of all this. It is characterized by inertia, inaction, ignorance, and sleepishness. Sleeping on Nidra Alasya Pramadoktam. That Thomas Gita says, it means sleepishness, laziness, inaction, ignorance, and so on. Confusions, conflicts, and so on.
Swamiji, I know Ramakrishna said that Santa Guna is also a robber, the three robbers story.
Oh, yeah. Yes, those who are not familiar with this, I shall explain. You see, that story you should utter, then only it becomes relevant.
I tell the story.
And you tell the story.
Yeah, there are three robbers. They got hold of a man, and then plundered all his wealth.
Yes.
And then went to the forest, and the Tamaguna said, "We'll try him." No, we'll kill him, he said. Tamaguna said, "We'll kill him." No, then the Rajaguna came and said, "Why should we kill him? We shall tie him to a post, then he can't report to the police." Then they tied him, and the Sattvaguna came and said, "Oh, you have been badly bruised, I will release you." And then they took him to the road, and then they said, "There's your house." Then the man said, "Oh, you have been so nice to me, why don't you come with me?" "No, I'm not a robber. Police will catch me if I come there. I won't come." Sattvaguna was just a robber. But then he said, "Oh, kind, he shows you the way, but he won't take you there. This is Mr. Sattva. Pure Sattva, you know, can...
Yes, yeah. Yes. Now the story, this comes in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, teaching to Sri Ramakrishna. The idea is this, the highest supreme spiritual enlightenment goes beyond all the three gunas. It goes beyond all the three gunas. But Sattva guna is very close to the highest spiritual development. I shall narrate the story once more. See, a person was robbed, beaten, ambushed by three robbers. The three robbers are represented by Tamoguna, Rajoguna, and Sattvaguna. Now, the other two robbers, Tamoguna and Rajoguna, one fellow said, "Tie him," another fellow said, "Beat him," another fellow said, "Kill him," and there are these two people. Tamoguna fellow said, "You beat him and kill him." Other fellow said, "Tie him," but then he won't be able to report to the police. But Sattvaguna is represented by a person. Well, when the other two fellows have left, Tamoguna and Rajoguna have left, Sattvaguna comes and tells him. He unties, saves him from bondage, takes him, and shows him, "Here, this way, if you go, you can reach your home. Again, but I cannot enter the place because the policeman is standing. I also will be caught. Though I am much better than the other two robbers, I am still a robber, so I also will be arrested by the police." So, Sattvaguna is also a limitation. But it is a limitation which takes you beyond a limitation. A person who is well established in Sattvaguna naturally graduates, evolves. So the next stage, he goes beyond all the three gunas. It is guna atida. It is called in Gita. You find triguna atida. Somebody who has transcended all the three gunas. So the best way for a spiritual seeker to progress in spiritual life is to fill himself with sattvaguna. That will naturally take us to the highest spiritual goal. The other two can drag us in the opposite direction. But Sattvaguna, when we reach the highest level of perfection in Sattvaguna, can naturally take us to the highest spiritual goal. But in a liberated soul, in a highly elevated soul, these three gunas will be absent. But whenever that elevated soul, spiritually enlightened person works in this world, he will be dictated by Sattva guna. He will have no Rajo guna, no Tamo guna.
How about Jada Bharata? He was full of Tamo guna.
Jada Bharata, see, Jatabharata was pretending to be, that second related story in Bhagavata Purana. Jatabharata, in his previous life, you know, was a deer. Before that, he was a king. I shall narrate the story, otherwise this discussion won't be relevant to others. I'll just explain within a few minutes, we already exceeded time. Well, in ancient times, there was a great king, a mighty king. His name was Bharata. And incidentally, India got its name Bharata from this king. That's one view. There are other views also. Anyway, that's not very important. Now, this king was a very noble, very enlightened, very able ruler. When he became very old, well, when his own grandchildren had already grown, then he retired to the forest and stayed there. He spent all his time in meditation and spiritual practices. But one day it so happened that a pregnant female deer was being chased by a lion. And this pregnant deer, tried to jump across a small stream. In that effort, it fell in the stream and he gave birth to a baby deer. Now the king felt so much of sympathy. He plunged into the stream, saved the baby deer, but the old deer had already passed away. This small deer started growing in this king's hermitage. Now, this king, the old emperor who had given up his kingdom, his palace, everything, became so much attached to this small deer. So when he was about to die, he could not think of God. He could not think of Atman. In fact, he had left his palace, he had given up his kingdom, comforts, everything, to spend his time in meditation on Atman, to get spiritual enlightenment. But somehow he forgot that he became attached to this deer. So when he was breathing his last, he was thinking, oh, what will happen to me after my death? Some wild animals will come and kill and eat this deer. With that thought, he passed away. In the next life, he was born as a deer. Now, in Vedantic tradition, the thought that comes to our mind at the time of death will influence your next life. This is Vedantic tradition. But that thought will be the totality of all the thoughts and actions that we have gone through in that life. So if one has done a lot of good meritorious deeds, good things, those memories will come. So we will get a higher life. This is the Vedantic concept. So this king came, he was born as a deer. But he did not forget his past, because the deer was an emperor who had done so much of meditation, so much of spiritual introspection. That won't be lost. That will remain in his deposit, a spiritual deposit. So the deer never went outside the hermitage. He remained in the hermitage, and in course of time he died. Now the king who left his palace to meditate on God, meditated for years, and passed away thinking about the deer. The deer in the next life, the deer spent all his time meditating on God or Atman. So in the next life, the deer was born as a great sage. But it remembered one point: too much of attachment, too much of entanglement will create problems. So what did that Jatabharata? He pretended to be a mute and dunce, but actually he was a highly elevated soul. So King Raghugana and a few other great saints, saintly kings, recognized him and honored him. That story is another part of this mythological story. The idea is this: we should try to store our mind with spiritually elevating thoughts as much as possible. So that will always remain there. Good deeds, good words, good actions, somehow, some kind of mental or intellectual or emotional association with spiritually elevating ideas. That is always helpful. So we have already exceeded our time. Om Shanti Shanti.